When you invest in ETFs, your capital is at risk. This show is for professional investors only.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of Thematic Matters, brought to you by Han ETFs. This episode will be joined by Kevin T. Carter, who's the founder of EMQQ, a new FMQQ ETF. So Kevin is an internationally recognized expert on emerging markets in China with over two decades of experience. So thanks for joining us, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into your ETFs in particular and the theme they capture, I thought it might be good to hear a bit more about your own background. So you've been invested in emerging markets in China for many years. How and why did you develop this focus?
It's a long story. You know, I was always very interested in emerging markets and just, you know, the world and other countries and cultures in general. And I did some pretty extensive traveling in emerging markets and frontier markets. Right after I got married, my wife and I took a several-month trip around parts of the emerging world. But professionally, I got involved somewhat randomly. As you know, I've long worked with Bert Malkiel, the Princeton economist and Vanguard board member, who's, you know, one of the sort of founding fathers of indexing and ETFs. And while I'm a Warren Buffett person first, he and I have worked together in trying to solve some of the problems in investing, including China. And what happened was, right after Google went public, I ended up becoming a default investment advisor to a lot of the earliest Google people. And that was in early 2005. And Burton and I had just sold our company Active Index Advisors to Natixis, the French company. And what we did at Active Index Advisors was what's now called direct indexing, building your own customized S&P 500 portfolio with, you know, personal ESG screening and tax loss harvesting and so forth. And so we had just sold our company to Natixis, and Google had gone public. And when they went public, they asked Burton to talk to their employees about investing. And somehow some of these guys found me and said, "Hey, we want to do this thing you guys are doing." And so all of a sudden I was going back and forth to Mountain View in 2005, and Burton was going back and forth to China. He had a couple of his Princeton colleagues had left to teach economics in Beijing, and they had said to Burton, "You have to come see this. The China, we're coming back. We're capitalist. It's working, and it's going to keep working." And so Burton started going back and forth to China. I was going back and forth to Mountain View. And then Burton wrote a white paper about investing in China. And it got published in the Journal of Investment Consulting. And the guys at Google heard about it and said, "Hey, can Burton come down here and talk about investing in China?" And I said, "Sure." And the next time Burton was in town, we drove down to Mountain View from San Francisco. And Burton gave his talk about investing in China, and then all these Google people looked at me and said, "We want to invest in China." And I didn't know anything about China really at that point. I mean, I knew just a little bit, and I read Burton's white paper, but I had never been to China, and I really didn't even know what that meant to invest in China. But somehow, 16 years later, that's all I've done is try to figure out what is the best way to invest in China and emerging markets in general. And it took a little while, but I think we got it figured out.
Well, so yeah, it's interesting your password with Burton Malkiel. Obviously, like a lot of people know him for the quite famous book Around and Walk Down Wall Street, but he also did write a book, I think, in the late 2000s on China as well. Now, is this the same kind of thesis in the white paper you were just talking about?
The white paper became the book. The white paper was the short version. And I remember very well the book. I was one of the people that proofread the manuscripts as it came together. And actually, now that I think about it again, it's the book or the draft that I was reading. You know, I remember highlighting certain things and saying, "Well, we can do this, or we can help people invest in this place better than what was available at the time, which was the iShares FXI was the only exchange traded fund you could buy to invest in China. And it was a horrible, and remains a horrible way to try to capture the growth of China." But so yes, the book is just a longer version of the white paper.
So how much of these kind of ideas feed into EMQQ and when you kind of initially set it up?
Basically, after the talk ended, these people looked at me and said, we want to invest in China.
Yeah.
And I said, okay. And we drove back to San Francisco, and I walked right over to the portfolio managers, and I said, hey, the Google guys want to invest in China. I assumed we would just use the ETF that existed. It was pretty new, but it did exist. That I assumed we'd use the iShares China ETF with the ticker FXI. And I asked for the list of companies because, you know, again, I'm an Omaha person and I want to understand what exactly do we own? What are the businesses? And so I wanted the list of companies. And before they gave me the list, Burton pulled me aside. And he said, look, when you look at the list, you're going to see that it's full of government-owned banks and oil companies. And that sounded bad to me for what I think would be obvious reasons to most listeners, but I don't think of government-owned businesses as being operated in an optimal type of fashion. And Burton went on to explain to me that that was very much the case, that these companies were conflicted. The state-owned banks would make bad loans. They'd make loans to people that were already bankrupt just to keep the employees from protesting. And when he walked through how these state-owned enterprises work and all the corruption, I said, why would we invest in these companies at all? Because with my simple Omaha brain, earnings equals value, and it's the growth of earnings that is the growth of value. And that's what you need if you're going to make money as an investor. And if you're telling me that the people that run these companies don't care about that, why would you invest in them at all? And in the case of the China index, it was 80% state-owned enterprises, which I think, and by the way, the broader emerging markets index is the MSCI Emerging Market Index. It's about a third in state-owned enterprises. And if you counted the Chaebol in Korea and the oligarchs in Russia, it's about half of the MSCI index today. And that explains why the return has been so disappointing in both China and in the emerging markets and asset class, because the indexes are broken and they don't represent the growth. They represent the legacy economy, the corrupt economy, the oil and banks and commodities. And it was 80% of the China index. So I knew that wasn't really going to work. And then the other thing that you learn pretty quick, and I mean, I knew this, China's got a lot of people and they want stuff. I mean, there was a book written 100 years ago documenting this huge consumer market in China, and it wasn't too close to the story, but I had traveled and seen that, you know, everywhere I went, people asked me if they could have my Nikes and my Nike hat. I knew people out in the world, you know, that wanted stuff, the stuff that we take for granted. But this story of the consumer, because, you know, what's happening in the developing world is these thing that's emerging are the people. Their incomes are going up off of a low base, and they want stuff. They want more and better food. They want more and better clothing, a second coat, another pair of shoes. They want a heater and other appliances. They want to go to a movie and take a vacation. And that's the story, and it's well-documented, and that's, you know, what McKinsey calls the biggest growth opportunity in the history of capitalism. You've got 85% of the world's people in emerging and frontier markets, and they want the same stuff we take for granted. And so that was well documented. So I get back from Google and I'm presented with, okay, you want to invest in China. Here's the ETF. It's got 8% in consumption in the consumer durables and consumer staples. And it's got 80% in government-owned banks and oil companies. Well, that just was very clear, not optimal if you wanted to capture the growth of China and then emerging markets more broadly. It took a while, but I realized that it really was just about the consumption story. And investors should leave everything else out and just invest in the emerging market consumer sector.
Yeah. I just kind of going back to what you said briefly on the kind of MSCI EM or MSCI China index, it's not capturing the growth. And the one stat I always like is that so the US economy since the early 90s has kind of increased by something like threefold. In contrast, China's economy has increased something like 26, 27-fold. Yet, if you look at returns of American equities to China using MSCI or FTSE indices, we obviously know American equities have outperformed. So it's kind of clearly there's something wrong there in terms of the what is in the indexes aren't capturing that kind of growth. So with all that in mind, what you said, kind of maybe you want to then kind of give the listeners kind of an overview pitch of what EMQQ is today and what's in the portfolio and how it does capture this kind of this greatest opportunity in history of capitalism, as you quoted McKinsey.
Well, so that's perfect. So what I was saying is, you know, I concluded you just buy the consumer stocks, right? That's the answer. Leave out the banks and the oil. And there happened to be an emerging market consumer ETF here in the United States that I didn't have anything to do with, but I knew it existed. And you know, when people would ask me what's the best way to invest in emerging markets, I told them to buy that. And it was about 8 years ago, I had a friend call me one morning and she had a 3-year-old daughter and she asked me, what's the best emerging markets ETF for my daughter's college fund? So the next 15 years. And I started to tell her to buy the emerging market consumer ETF, which again, it owned the food companies and the clothing companies and the department stores and so forth in emerging markets. But then as I was about to answer her, I had this light bulb moment because I, you know, when I answered her call, it was on a smartphone that was sitting on the seat next to me, which I had one, but it was pretty new and I could already see how it was changing my family's consumption. And so as I was starting to answer her, I had this light bulb moment and I said, wait a minute, the best consumption companies aren't called consumption companies. They're, you know, the consumer, they're called technology companies now. And I didn't appreciate this, but at the time, I could see that these companies, they were growing at 100%. I mean, it was incredible, the growth, and they were very profitable. But that's how I decided to launch EMQQ. And I can see now very clearly what's happening. There's three different things you get in EMQQ. And we here and you there, we're part of these three mega trends, but we kind of forget that we were the first people and maybe everybody else isn't where we are yet. And those three mega trends are, first of all, consumption. Everybody else wants another pair of shoes and to go on a vacation, et cetera. The second mega trend is called the computer. I mean, when I got that call, I answered it on my smartphone, which was pretty new, but I had a computer for 20 years before that. Well, most of the world's getting their first computer right now. It's not on their desk and it never will be. And it's getting better and more affordable every year. It's a $60 or $80 smartphone running on Android in most cases. And it's bringing with it the third mega trend, which I've had for 25 years, called the internet. So basically, you've got billions of people, 6.5 billion people. They're getting their first ever computer, their first ever internet access. They don't have a bank account and a debit card. They don't have a cable TV on the wall. And there's no Target store. And so they're leapfrogging us and are in many ways more digital than we are. And the net result fundamentally is the sector has had revenue growth on average of about 38% for the last decade, which I'm pretty sure makes it the fastest growing sector in the world ever. I'm not positive, but I have a $100,000 reward for anybody that can show me a sector that ever grew at 38% for a decade.
Interesting. Obviously, the big news story came to Chinese stocks last year was the increased regulation of these consumer tech firms that you described. And so obviously as a result, share prices suffered, particularly kind of Alibaba, Tencent, these kind of big names, and those listed on US exchanges in particular. Could you walk us through kind of what happened and then your assessment of it and why you're still confident about the future of Chinese companies?
Sure. Well, I mean, let's just be real clear. We've not just had poor performance, you know, we've had a major correction. I mean, the biggest I've seen. There's no sugarcoating it. We're down over 50% from our peak. We were up 25% in the first 6 weeks of last year, so the annual number wasn't quite as bad. But either way, we're down and far out, at least in the stock market. You would think that these companies are teetering on the brink of collapse based on the chart that Mr. Market's given us. And most of that's been because of fear about China. And, you know, let me just say just very plainly up front, this whole thing is way, way, way overdone, this China fear. And it started in early July. And you know, with a Didi IPO, which was a sloppy thing, and multiple parties are and should be sort of embarrassed by how that played out, including the Chinese government, because, you know, the problem there, without going into all the nuances, the company went public, and the next day the Chinese government announced they were reviewing whether or not Didi, which is the Uber of China, if you will, whether they were in full compliance with the cybersecurity laws of China, which were put in place about 5 years ago. And the company acknowledged they weren't in compliance, and it set off this fear amongst investors, however, that somehow the Chinese government was, you know, going to come in and basically steal their money, which is this general fear that you know, investors have about the Chinese government. And that regulatory episode, which put people very much on edge, was followed 2 weeks later by the regulations put into the for-profit education sector, which included forcing those companies that were teaching the core curriculum, and in other words, teaching the kids the things they were supposed to be learning in their government-provided schooling, that if you were going to tutor kids in that, you couldn't do it for a profit. And unfortunately, for some investors that were in, there were three publicly traded online education companies, Chinese companies trading in the United States. If you were an investor in those, you basically lost all your money.
Yeah.
So for the first time in the 16 years I've been involved, the Chinese government did something that caused investors to lose money. It wasn't exactly the way people thought it would happen. They thought the Chinese government would just steal their money somehow. And they didn't really do that. They are addressing a social problem in their country. And unfortunately, if you own those stocks, you lost 80 or 90% of your money. We did not own those companies. But either way, the thing that's happening is the Chinese government, like our government and governments everywhere, is dealing with the fact that these technology platform companies, the Facebooks, the Amazons, the Googles, the Alibabas and Tencents, they've gotten really, really big, really, really fast. And they're very important and powerful. And no government anywhere has kept up with them. And so now you have governments trying to figure out what to do, what's going on in the regulatory framework that needs to be addressed. And that's not a China thing. It's on the front page of our papers all the day, you know, every day, as our government deals with this. And, you know, you've got the FANG CEOs in front of Congress and whistleblowers on 60 Minutes. And this is not just a China thing. And I think that, you know, if you step back and look at the situation, everything the Chinese government has done, I think they should have done. At least the goals were good, and they're not there to kill capitalism. And that's the biggest problem is investors see the Chinese government do anything related to the companies, and they think that's it. They're going to stop letting these companies be capitalist. They're going to, you know, Jack Ma's missing and all these boogeyman things. And it's just headlines and noise and the delisting threat. I mean, I've never seen such an overreaction to anything in the stock market that I can remember, as this incredible fear over the Chinese internet companies and the regulations.
So I guess it's the idea that, you know, governments all around the world are trying to get their regulations to catch up with the growth of tech companies and other kind of new companies. But because of the legislation in China emanates from the Central Committee of a Communist Party rather than a parliament or a Senate, etc., it's kind of interpreted in a different way.
Well, yes. I mean, look, the China does have, you know, it's not just 10 guys running the country. I mean, they have one out of every 12 or 13 people is a member of the party, and certainly it's more than just the you know, guys at the top saying what to do. China has a government that is well educated. They're very smart. Many of them have gone to our best colleges. Some of them have taught at our best colleges. So they're smart, and And what they have, though, is they don't have the lobbying and the special interest groups and the money that gets in the way of our getting these regulations and things addressed. And they have studied our laws and regulations. They've studied the German and other European laws related to financial services, related to monopolies and antitrust issues. And they're able to take their learnings and implement them in a way that they think is best for the long-term benefit of their economy, which they know that capitalism has served greatly as they have risen from basically nothing over the last 30 years to probably the most powerful economic force on the planet today.
Yeah.
With capitalism. They know it works. They're not going to go away from it.
Recently, you launched the FMQQ ETF, essentially EMQQ, but without the China exposure. So obviously we've just heard you kind of your thesis on China kind of broadly remains intact. The fear is overdone, but I guess the immediate outside observer, the launch of FMQQ could be interpreted as kind of you being worried about China, making an ex-China ETF, but that's not the case. So could you explain what the thinking behind FMQQ is and why it's worth launching this fund without China exposure?
Okay, well, you're right. And I hate that fact that people say, aha, that's because now you're afraid of China. And that's absolutely not the case. It was your firm and one of your founders, Nick, who made me, he called me, 12 or 13 months ago and said, hey, the CMQQ's worked out really well. We should do something else. And I said, well, I don't want to do anything else. I've got the best emerging markets ETF on the planet. I've got the best growth story in the world, and it's going to continue to be that for a long time. Why would I make up something else just to do that? And as you know, he can be sort of persistent. And I said to him, I would go through the motions. If somebody made me do another product, what would it be? But that I wouldn't launch it, because we're EMQQ and EMQQ is what we do, and that's all we're going to do. But I agreed to just, spend a little time on the whiteboard thinking about it and so forth. And we had had people here, different investors over the years, ask us if we could make something that was like a small mid-cap version of EMQQ, or because a lot of people own Alibaba and Tencent as individual stocks, especially here in the United States. And so they're like, well, I've already got that. Can you give me the rest of it? So that was one idea. But very quickly, as I was just looking at the portfolio and the different, there's 46 different emerging and frontier markets. And something I knew was that China was the biggest. But something I didn't appreciate, at least numerically, was that China's e-commerce market was four times as big as the other 45 emerging markets combined, right? I mean, China's, all of the countries that have stock markets are categorized by FTSE and MSCI as being developed, emerging, or frontier. And the criteria for those classifications are broad. If we were going to re-categorize every country by the internet and e-commerce, China's the most developed in the world by far. And its e-commerce penetration is the highest amongst major economies. It's about 30% presently. It's even more than the US, which is 20 to 25% e-commerce penetration. The other 45 countries beyond China have e-commerce penetration of less than 5%. So China's five times further along in the story than the non-China internet companies. And the other thing that we had seen about the time Nick called, we were seeing an explosion of IPOs beyond China. There were IPOs from Kazakhstan, from Poland, from Uruguay. And it just struck me one day when I looked at we had sort of prepared some slides of looking at like China versus the rest of it. And And the three slides that really stood out were that the non-China companies were just now passing $100 billion in revenue annually, which is where the China companies were 8 years ago when we launched. Yeah. And that there were four times as many people in the FMQQ countries, if you will, the other emerging markets beyond China. Four times as many people. And the penetration rate, as I said, was only 5% versus 25% for China. So in terms of long term, you've got four times as many people and five times, you know, you got a lot more, a very, very long runway. And so if the China internet story's, you know, in the middle of the game, as we would say here in the US, you know, the fifth inning, the outside of China, in India, in Pakistan, in Indonesia, Brazil, Nigeria, it's the first inning for this story. And it's going to go on for a long, long time. And EMQQ investors should be very excited about this because half of EMQQ is beyond China. And FMQQ investors get a pure slice of the non-China story.
Looking at a lot of the companies in the FMQQ index, it's very interesting, like kind of how, you know, you might expect that the kind of e-commerce demand in these developing countries would be filled by Alibaba or Amazon or some other kind of big tech company from the US, the way obviously e-commerce in Europe is dominated by Amazon. At least in Western Europe, but in these places, kind of like Indonesia and India and stuff, it's homegrown companies. I kind of, could you explain what this phenomenon is, what's behind it, and why homegrown companies being more successful than the penetration of outside firms?
Okay, that's a great question, and it's a mixed bag. It really does vary by country.
Yeah,
and it varies by how quickly the Amazons focused on them before anybody could move locally. It depends on how easy or hard that, you know, it is or was for the FANG people to get the government and other regulatory things needed to operate. And it depends on the entrepreneurs who step up before Amazon gets there. And I'm using Amazon as a catch-all for Uber or Amazon or Netflix, whatever it is. And so it's a mixed bag. And so if we start, I'll just go sort of geographically and hit the highlights. In India, where there's a war happening, Amazon isn't number one, but it's pretty close to number one in e-commerce. The leader is Flipkart, which was founded by two guys that left Amazon and started Flipkart and have beaten Amazon so far. Now, Flipkart is now controlled by Walmart. Tencent is a shareholder as well. It will probably come public later this year, but they're the leader, but they're battling with Amazon. And one of the problems is the Indian government. You know, the Facebook is big, Google's big, they got in, but the Indian government has basically said, we're not comfortable with you winning this. We want homegrown Indian winners of this. And so now we're at a critical stage because they're, you know, they're in courts now, and there's a short summary of the situation as regards the one and two players there, or actually the third player as well. So in addition to Flipkart and Amazon, you have Reliance Jio, and that's the digital arm of Reliance Industries, which is owned and controlled by the Ambani family. And it's a conglomerate that started in oil and petrochemicals, but they've realized very smartly that the future is digital, and they built the largest 4G network and have 400 million Indian subscribers now. And they have launched several e-commerce and otherwise digital platforms and apps. And they've, and one of the things in emerging markets that's happened and continues to happen is for distribution purposes, physical traditional retail chains, you know, convenience store chains, gas stations, electronics stores, those physical locations have value for distribution in emerging markets. And Reliance has a very large portfolio of retail locations in its portfolio. One of its competitors, Future Group, got into some financial trouble and agreed to be acquired by Amazon.
Right.
And the Reliance people realized, wait a minute, we don't want that to be in Amazon's hands. We want that in our hands. And they convinced the CEO of the company, of Future, to basically, even though he had signed an agreement to be acquired, to walk away from the agreement. And Amazon, of course, sued immediately. And in Singapore, won the case, but the Indian courts don't seem to agree. So that's one way it's playing out in a very, probably the most important place, because that's the next wave behind China. So, and then you still have that favoritism thing. I mean, India's government is very protective, and that goes with manufacturing, and it's certainly going to go with the internet companies.
Yeah.
And so it's very early in seeing how that plays out. Good news is India's got lots of entrepreneurs, hundreds of unicorns, and the India story is going to be extremely large in the next 10 years. We just now, you know, we've created an India Internet and e-commerce index, and there's not enough companies yet to create a product that tracks it, because you need 20 companies to basically make a product.
Yeah.
And we only have 18, but there's 30 IPOs in the pipeline. So we suspect pretty quick we'll have enough companies to put together a product that is just focused on India. And Goldman Sachs thinks there could be 300 Indian internet IPOs. So that's what's going on in India. And then the rest of the world, it's a mixed bag. I'll give you two examples and kind of why they happened the way they did. South America is dominated by Mercado Libre.
Yeah.
Amazon is way behind. They've got good share in Mexico, but other than that, it's all Mercado Libre. And that's because of entrepreneurs. You had the founders graduated from Stanford Business School in 1999 and went back and said, let's build our own Amazon. And they did. And it's been a huge success. And as is happening all over the developing world, not as much here, it didn't just become the Amazon of Brazil and Argentina and Mexico. It became the PayPal and Venmo.
Yeah.
And because the financial services opportunity is, because nobody has bank accounts and debit cards. And so to offer these types of services, these companies create their own payments platform. And as their user base gets into the tens and hundreds of millions, that payments platform becomes its own financial services business. And because once you get the money on the phone, you can sell insurance, investment products, etc. And so that was all about the entrepreneurs. And what's continued to happen now is this incredible virtuous cycle in South America in particular, where the founders of Mercado Libre set up a venture fund a decade ago, and then, or at least two of the three, and they funded the next wave. And the entrepreneurs, they're going to Harvard, they're going to Stanford, they're working at Amazon, they're working at Facebook, they're working at Google, and then they say, I want to do this myself. And so in South America, the homegrown players are winning. And then in Eastern Europe, another example would be Uber. So the Google of Russia is a company, Yandex, which trades on the NASDAQ, been part of EMQQ from the beginning. Yandex, historically, the Google of China, is also the Uber of China. Now, Uber went and competed with Yandex Taxi, but Yandex Taxi crushed them, and Uber left and took a minority stake in Yandex Taxi. So it really depends on the market, and it's a combination of timing, regulations, and entrepreneurs.
So just to finish, Kevin, obviously you've covered it all already, but if you could give a quick sum up of why you think investors should have emerging markets in their portfolio, and why e-commerce and tech platforms are the optimal way to gain that exposure.
Well, look, I mean, I've become sort of radicalized about my thinking about asset allocation. So, but if you're investing in emerging markets, implicit in the name emerging is some sort of growth. And if you're going to go there looking for growth, you're not going to find it in the legacy economy and the banks and oil companies. You need to go to the consumer story. And, you know, as I said, McKinsey calls this the biggest growth opportunity in the history of capitalism, this rise of the emerging market consumer. And if they're right, then I think this is definitely the best chapter because, you know, I mean, look, you don't have to look very far. I mean, if you have a smartphone, you know how you're doing things now and how it's changed your life. And I've still never met anybody that used to have a smartphone. And every 3 seconds, or every second rather, three people in the emerging markets are getting their first ever computer in form of a smartphone, their first ever internet access. And as I said, it's very, very early. So if you want to capture the growth of emerging markets, I think we've captured it. Anyone that's a long-term investor, I don't see how you can't have this as part of your approach.
Thanks, Kevin. And thanks, everyone else, for listening. We'll be back next time for another theme. Bye for now.